Welcome to Placemaking, a Kraftwerk podcast. My name is Trevor Hightower. We believe that the buildings we live in shape how we live and who we become. Through placemaking, we get to talk to the owners, operators, and innovators who are the people shaping the buildings that shape us. Well, it's beyond fun to have Bryce Butler on the podcast. I'm honored to call Bryce a friend. I was thinking about how to describe Bryce, and here is my best shot. He's a philosophical, massive action taker. His best accomplishment that I think he will attest to is being married to an amazing woman, Bethany, and they have four wonderful daughters who, from the stories I hear from Bryce, are even more interesting than their dad. The Butler crew live on a farm just outside of their beloved Louisville, Kentucky. They're rolling deep with two dogs, 14 chickens, three bunnies, and two ducks. That was the last audit that I saw, Bryce. But he's really a force of nature, founder and managing director of Access Venture, which we'll talk a lot about. He's been an Army officer, a pastor, an adjunct instructor, an author. And as we'll get into, he's been quite literally a placemaker. So I invite anyone who's listening to this to subscribe to his podcast, More Than Profit. You'll find many topics he has great wisdom and experience on. But seeing as this is the placemaking podcast, it's a really cool opportunity to focus in on just one of Bryce's passions and expertise, which is, in fact, placemaking. So, Bryce, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, man. Thank you. And the audit is always changing on the farm, so I appreciate that. Yeah, it's we're down on our ducks. The bald eagles are pretty bad. So,
oh man, yeah. You have any videos of that? That's amazing.
I have some pictures. So
that's incredible. Speaking of places, that's a special place. Just hearing you describe your farm, and maybe we can get into that later. I thought, you know, you do combine such thoughtfulness with action, and it's a rare combination that I want the leaders listening to get inspired by. And the best way, I think, for us to just get right into it is, a specific real estate story. So your investment and work in Shelby Park, it's really the genesis of Access Ventures and what you'll talk about as a one pocket philosophy. But I would love to know, give us the setting of the place Shelby Park and where Bryce Butler was just before you started doing some placemaking work there.
Yeah. No, so I was managing a family office. So as I kind of started the work in Shelby Park, I worked for a family that was doing a lot of what's known as like impact investing, or even their private philanthropy, all the way up through venture capital. A lot of stuff internationally. And so that was kind of what I was doing right up to kind of our work in Shelby Park. So Shelby Park is a neighborhood in Louisville, Kentucky. It's about a 15 square block neighborhood. At the time, there were about 330 vacant properties in that 15 square block neighborhood. 42% of people living below the poverty line and a 17% unemployment. And so when you kind of put all that together, a very distressed neighborhood, and, you know, as you can attest, I'm sure, in Dallas and many other cities, it's not atypical of a community that's been distressed. And so having worked for a family office and working with this family on kind of what they were doing both in the Louisville market where they're residents, but also internationally, the question was like, what could we do? How could we do this differently? And what it really started as kind of this a sidecar real estate holding company is never intended to be anything beyond that. And my thesis was, can we take non-traditional debt financing, patient debt, from a couple of high net worth individuals? And my financial thesis was, I'm going to do better than your CD, and you've got money sitting in the bank, and we can put it to work. So why don't you loan it to me, and we'll go buy vacant properties and repurpose vacant and abandoned properties and provide housing, better quality housing. And so that was another part of the thesis as well. And so that's kind of how we got into it, but we learned a ton kind of over the years.
Well, that's what I want to get into, because it's fascinating, as I have talked to you in the past about the your journey and your path there? Because to give the audience maybe the bottom line up front, what was the total number of houses you invested in, and what was some of the results of the strategy that you came into Shelby Park with?
Yeah, our original thesis was $500,000. So in Shelby Park, Louisville, that neighborhood average home price was about $80,000. Mm-hmm. Not many of them are actually worth that, but that's kind of what the fair market value was in that neighborhood. And so our thesis was, with $500,000, we can do 8 single family homes. And we were initially targeting single family, but as we got into it, we recognized that there was a multifamily kind of component and also some commercial property. So our vision kind of for it expanded as we think about placemaking. Mm-hmm. It went from an individual kind of real estate strategy of like single family property redevelopment into single family, multifamily, commercial, and recognizing mm-hmm. that a community is complex. So the problems yes. that the community members are facing are complex, and we can't come at it from a placemaking perspective and say, we only do X or we only do Y. Yes. And so we had to create a blended strategy, because at the heart of our thesis was the community. Mm. And then we think about money and the properties in which we were in reinvesting as tools to facilitate growth in that community. And so those were some of the things we learned over time. So we inevitably ended up doing, I think, 20 different units, residential units. We did a lot of different things. Like we pegged the rent at the fair market value of about $825 a month. Mm-hmm. But what we were able to do is, because of the type of capital that we raised, I could put more into the property. Mm-hmm. So our competition were slumlords, people that were buying a property at auction for $15,000-$20,000, but maybe painting it, not really fixing anything, but charging the fair market value of $825 a month in rent. Mm. And so, you know, and that's what the market can bear, that people in that neighborhood could afford that. They were the working poor, and that was a reasonable income for the rent for the working poor. But it's a horrible home. I mean, there's no insulation, HVAC is shot, single pane windows. And so they would pay 3 times what you and I would pay in utility costs, because the quality of the home. And so that's how the slumlords made their money. They made their money because they put $25,000-$30,000 into it, but they're charging a rent as if the property's worth $80,000.
Right.
And so because of the patient debt, we were able to say, you know what, my capital cost is a lot cheaper. Mm. So I can put $60,000 into the home and still get enough off of that to cover my debt costs and to generate the profit I need to do the work that we're doing.
Yes.
And then I could do high efficiency HVAC and double pane windows and insulation, all of those things, and then actually bring down that total cost of housing for that resident.
Yes. Innovative and patient capital structure led to you being able to really change the housing, the product, make them a lot more livable and affordable. And then you realized you mentioned this as you were talking, that it's this comprehensive solution that's not just the real estate, it's the community. So you went in with this intent to improve the community, you created better housing, and then what did you realize? You had mentioned this, you need to actually pure economical terms, you have to really foster the demand side of the equation. But from your missional standpoint, you wanted to really foster the community. And so what's neat about this is, I think it gives our listeners the storyline of Access Ventures and the path that you took from there.
Yeah. And I think some of the, we started off doing housing, and we're like, our whole thing is like, we want to rebuild this community. We want to do so patiently. We want to allow the residents to participate in the growth of this community. But as we got into it, you start to deal with a lot of different factors. So, joblessness. So we partnered with homeless shelters and halfway houses to actually do some of the redevelopment work. So we pay people to actually do the demo and reconstruction, and hired a general contractor that knew how to work with that population. We partnered with churches and local nonprofits in the neighborhood association and mobilized monthly cleanup days that worked both on our properties, but also in the community, doing community gardens and street cleanups. So over the course of 3 years that we were really active, we mobilized 3,500 volunteer hours. And I think all in, that cost us maybe over 3 years, $20,000 of like burgers and hot dogs and Coke and supplies. So you think about that, mobilizing 3,500 hours of volunteers, roughly, I mean, average 30 a month of people showing up to do that. It's a really low cost. And so again, those are some of the things we did. But then we also found ourselves in small business lending, because when you start to contend with the joblessness rate, and it's like, okay, I can get a better quality home at the fair market value, 825. But if that person doesn't have a job and there's no economic activity in this community, how are they going to afford that rent, even though it's a better quality home? And so we found ourselves actually looking at small business lending, because small businesses are the biggest job creators. So we did a revolving loan fund. And so as I've thought about placemaking over the years, it's really kind of like, you know, an ecosystem in nature is very integrated and complex. It's this integrated web of kind of different species. That's how communities function. And yet what we do is we come in with very simple binary kind of linear solutions. Mm-hmm. And what we've got to think through, especially as placemakers, is more of a comprehensive and complex. Complex is not necessarily complicated. It's just, we've got to like look at the needs of the community and say, how do we solve for that with different types of capital? And so create a comprehensive strategy. And so where does patient debt fit in? Where does traditional equity fit in? Where does venture debt fit? I mean, like, so you start to like, and then all of a sudden you create this blended portfolio, and the capital financial return expectations are there, but you can actually look at it more comprehensively and bring more to bear for that community.
I think our audience is starting to see why I described you as so thoughtful. You are you're so first principle based, and they see you have your values. And then out of that, you said, well, I want to do something in Shelby Park. And then you took incremental steps, and then you realized, oh my goodness, this is a comprehensive problem. The solution needs to be comprehensive. And so we need to really, if we're going to, you know, just create better real estate, we have to create a better community. And I love that as a learning for placemaking and on this show. I think it'd be really helpful, because what you basically described is what Access Ventures became. It became this vehicle that could have these different funding sources and different expectations for what this capital will do versus that capital. Give us a quick overview of Access Ventures, you know, maybe how it started there initially in Shelby Park, and then maybe to the scale that you're in today.
Yeah, it's constantly evolving. So we are structured as what's called a private operating foundation, but under that kind of structure, we can do a lot of different. So we have a venture fund. We do alternative investments. And so even talking about placemaking, so as an endowed kind of private operating foundation, what we look at is with our managed assets, how can we align those even further with our values and mission? And so if our mission, as we see it, is to help more people access the economy, to ensure that they are able to kind of move through it and pursue the opportunities that they desire as individual citizens, how do we do that? So we've done housing, we've done micro lending, we've done venture financing, but then even on our managed assets, we ask those same questions. And so we invest in solutions like affordable housing bonds or renewable energy infrastructure funds, different things that we think help communities and help people more broadly. But at the end of it, like you said, our values and our mission kind of are informing those decisions. And so we kind of put on the table, what are we hoping to see accomplished in the world, as well as what are the financial expectations within that asset class over this time period? So both of those are real questions that I think we all have to ask every day. We need our money to grow. We want to make profits so that we can continue to do the work that we're doing. But at the same time, the way in which it's making money, i.e. increasing in what is it doing in the world? And so fundamentally, every business has an impact. Every business is either positive, negative, or neutral. And so how do we align our resources, our money, in more of the positive camp versus the negative camp. So
yes,
those are the questions we ask. And, you know, so even the stuff we did in Shelby Park, you know, as we looked at scale over the years, there was something a couple of years ago that came out, the Opportunity Zone legislation. And so worked with a friend of mine and basically took that thesis around kind of a street corner, commercial corridor with residential kind of behind that, and turn it into an Opportunity Zone strategy that is now in Austin and San Antonio, Baltimore, and also across the Southeast. So that kind of thesis has now permeated that strategy, because that type of capital really works well with a strategy like that.
Well, I'm so glad you brought that up. You're referencing Blueprint Local. So this is a Opportunity Zone fund that you helped incubate. And it, what I hear is a lot of the learnings and principles you took from Shelby Park when this new legislation came, and many in the audience are very aware, you're making equity investments and developments in these places now. But yeah, I want to double click into the strategy with Blueprint Local and really maybe highlight on a big idea that you're a big champion of, which is a one pocket mindset. So a traditional investor will look at an opportunity zone and obviously see, hey, this is a great opportunity to build an asset, make a good financial return, and I'm going to do good because I'm making a development. And that's certainly true. But then you maybe take it a step further. I'd love to hear more of that philosophy of the one pocket mentality, in particularly applied to a topic that I think many in our audience are aware of, is an opportunity zones.
Yeah. So the one pocket mindset, I mean, I think historically, the approach to kind of community impact has been more of a two pocket, and that's where the one pocket kind of concept comes up. So this idea that go out and make as much profit as you can, and one pocket, that's the maximize wealth, grow my assets, and with no consideration necessarily for how that money is being deployed, other than like getting as much money back as possible. And then in the other pocket, and never the two shall meet, the other pocket is the good work pocket. And so I make as much as I can, so that over here, the way I do good work is I make as much as I can and I go give it to nonprofits and other organizations. And we feel like that's bifurcated, because I think as business people, we have been we've been given the skills to think very strategically about how business impacts communities. So the one pocket mindset is more to say, you don't have to necessarily sacrifice financial return to have impact in the community. What we should be starting with is more our values and our vision and a mission. And so the starting point should be, what do we want to see in the world? What do I really care about? And then to like I said, find different investments that help accomplish that. So still have a multi-asset strategy, still have a diversified portfolio, still pursue profit. But if we can actually bring those values into the conversation, and as we're targeting an alternative fund, or we're looking at our public equities, or we're looking at a real asset like real estate, how can we do that type of work or that investment in a way that maximizes a financial return, but also potentially could have a positive impact? So opportunity zones, you know, the whole legislation is kind of part and parcel to that. It's taking tax advantage money and deploying it into, you know, distressed communities that have been defined as below poverty line or whatever. So that's great. but even there are limitations, because it's one, you know, it's equity. You know, you can't do debt through an opportunity zone fund. And so again, back to the conversation with Shelby Park, if we come in just with an opportunity zone into a distressed community, that might come in and buy up a lot of real estate and make it look really pretty. And that the danger that a lot of communities kind of cry out about is gentrification. Right. And what they really mean is not just gentrification, because gentrification literally means to improve, right? It's like, I think what people generally are frustrated with is the pace of gentrification that pushes longtime residents out. And so another phrase that I've heard is gentrification with justice, or like a better paced gentrification. Mm-hmm. So I think what we've got to do is reframe how people think about it and how do we create mm-hmm. strategies where we still are improving? Because I think the goal is to reduce crime and improve the community, but at what pace? Who's participating? Right. So opportunity zones, the legislation and those funds have a great opportunity to do that. But I think what we've got to do is bring a one pocket approach, a mindset to that. I'll give you an example. I was talking with a developer who was doing an opportunity zone fund in and around the Shelby Park area. Mm-hmm. And he was coming in and looking at some commercial properties that we had. And I just kind of threw out and I said, well, what are you doing philanthropically? I said, I guarantee you have a donor advised fund at the Community Foundation.
Right.
And I guarantee the Community Foundation in principle is focused on early childhood education, mm-hmm. job training, better transportation for low wage workers. How much of that activity is already focused in the community that you're investing in? Right. And how could you align those two where it's like, oh my gosh, if we could create a below market loan fund with this CDFI through my donor advised fund and it's lending to businesses in the community, that's a benefit to the development that I'm working on because my ultimate goal is to improve this community. And yes, I need to get a return on this equity front, but I also care about the citizens. And so how can we create a holistic capital strategy that really is addressing the needs of those community members? And I think that's where if we can get alignment between the donor advised fund and the CDFI partnership and what the city's doing around its TIF dollars, all of those things lined up, that's where you have a one pocket mindset where we're coming in, we care about this community. We want to build this place. And yes, there's equity, but there's all these other pieces that we could also be a part of.
Yes. I'm so glad you gave that example because it really illustrates the definition of one pocket where all of your efforts are stacking up on each other to create really it's what's best for the investments, what's best for the community. I think that not only individuals, but as you mentioned, organizations get maybe their thinking is limited because you might be a big REIT and you are doing great development and you have an awesome culture and you have some opportunity zone investment. And then you might be, if you're a publicly traded REIT, you're giving, substantial money and to really good causes elsewhere, but to really think of it, I can actually have more direct impact if I align my giving dollars with my investment and don't look at them as these two separate things, but actually look at them as these mutually beneficial things that really drive everything that I would want from the investment side and on the impact side.
I mean, imagine if that REIT or some sort of commercial developer who's doing what you're saying is partnering with the local United Way, but they're not just stroking a check because they're a good citizen, but they see the work of the United Way as directly beneficial to the work they're doing. And it's mutually beneficial. So imagine that person partnering with the United Way and talking through like early childhood education and where they're applying that solution or after school programs, partnering with the local school board. And then you find yourself so all of a sudden, if you kind of come at it from like, what are you trying to do in the world? And, you put on the table, we need financial returns. Like, I think that's important to always put there. But what are you trying to see within this place? And what is the project you're trying to, like, you're going to find yourself more involved with the nonprofit sector, the mm-hmm. civic sector. I think even thinking through, are there regulations or limitations in legislation that need to be amended? And so that becomes maybe lobbying, but maybe just even education, like talking to legislators so that they understand the limitations of zoning restrictions that are inhibitive to kind of community growth. I think all of a sudden then that becomes a really, really exciting and fun and activating. I mean, when I talk to people, it's like, oh yeah, that's a lot more fun than mm-hmm. just going and buying a building. And you know what I mean? It's like buying a building's fun, but imagine like everything around that kind of working together.
I love it. And you're on the board of Blueprint Local. Can you give us a sense of just, you mentioned the different regions, Texas, and give us a sense of what you're excited about or what you see. Are they integrating some of these philosophies in their opportunity zone investments and developments?
Yeah, they are. I mean, they're trying. I mean, it's hard.
Yeah.
I mean, I want to think, this work isn't easy. I kind of, there's an idealism that I kind of can preach. And And I think, but it is hard work. But the team at Blueprint is that it is first and foremost a desire to impact these communities. The founder is Ross Baird, who you know, coming out of Village Capital. So he's just deeply has a heart for people and communities, specifically distressed communities. And so just knowing him and his DNA, he's built a great team. I'm actually not on the board. I'm on the advisory board for Impact. Mm-hmm. So I work with an Impact advisory board to kind of keep them rooted in that, that narrative and what the work is. But I mean, they're doing, they are doing work in Austin and San Antonio. That's kind of a corridor they're working in. Baltimore, they're actually the fund there, I think, is an owner in Penn Station, like the Penn Station, not the restaurant, and which is kind of fun. And then they recently partnered with LISC, which is the Local Initiative Support Corporation, which is the largest CDFI in the country across the Southeast United States in places like Birmingham, Alabama. And the importance for that is kind of one of the things Ross and I've always talked about is, again, the Opportunity Zone Fund itself is equity. And as the guidelines have rolled out, it preferences real estate, similar to like the new market tax credits have over the years. But the people that really are trying to build these complex strategies that build place recognize the importance of small business lending, early childhood education assistance. And so he's been really good about building those partnerships that align with the intent of the fund. And so because it's also real estate, the early goal was operating companies, but that's also proven difficult. So now there's work and discussion around raising a separate operating investment fund for operating companies inside of the Opportunity Zones. So it's an evolving discussion, but it's worthy work.
Very cool. Again, our audience, if they tune into your podcast or check out your website, both of which I'll have in the show notes, they'll get a sense of you have this aligned investment structure in multiple things, blockchain and venture and real estate is something that you've decrease in your portfolio. But I do know from some really great late night conversations, you have a passion, a vision, longing for better places, for better real estate. And like I mentioned at the start, when you get a vision and a why for something, that's really exciting to me because I'm pretty sure something's going to be created out of it, which is a talent of yours. So I would just love, what has you excited? What are you dreaming about in the category of real estate of placemaking right now?
Well, I need people like you to help me think through it. So I'm a former pastor, I'm a Christian. So I think about things like missionary support on the field. So I've got missionary friends that my wife and I support in, let's use an example, the south of France. Well, the organization that they are sent through doesn't allow them to buy property. And so they can rent. They're given a housing allowance to rent, but they can't purchase. And so when you think about when I think about placemaking, real estate is a tool and it's all about stewardship. And how do we facilitate and foster community and friendship and connection and relationship? Real estate's a great way to do that. And so when you think about like a missionary in the south of France where their whole existence is about building relationships with people, and then every 5 years they have to leave the country because of their visa limitations. And then when they come back because they're a renter, they're not going to be back in that same neighborhood. So it's almost like every 5 years they're starting from ground zero. And the inhibitor is literally property.
Right.
And so so one of the things I'd love to do is think up a way to purchase property that's aligned with a mission organizations like that, where they have income. Like he gets a rent, he just can't buy the property. So it's like, great, I'll go in, buy the property and you pay me rent. And then you can have like stability in place. That's placemaking. Yes. So those types of things. Or, how many friends of mine have like VRBO properties that are generating revenue, but there's all these off-cycle days. Like, what does it look like to create, who's doing the La Brea's of today? Who's starting the camps of today? Like I was a Boy Scout growing up and, somebody started that. Like there's this sense of property and place. Like those things are like resources that are leveraged for other things beyond just making money. Yes. So that's kind of like what I think about. I think about like retreat centers. I think about like that it can be sustainable financially, but also dual purposed. And so, I mean, I'm also one of the harebrained questions I have right now is who's starting the social service clubs of today, like the Rotaries. You look at most of these service organizations across the country, the the average age of membership is drastically going up. Right. And so younger generations don't see, they don't have a connection to those types of organizations. So what is the social club of today?
Yes.
And where does it physically reside? And how do we create systems and structures around that to facilitate community? Because if you look at the statistics, friendships on the decline, and we need to give places and ways for people to come together and connect.
Yes. Well, there's so much there.
I know you asked.
And I'm glad I did. I'm glad I did. Because, you know, there's the Putnam work of bowling alone and just the hollowing out of our communities. And it's the principles that you learn in Shelby Park and the one pocket mindset, they absolutely apply to creating places where community flourishes. And you do have this hollowing out of the places that we used to have as a society. Really, they're kind of evaporating. So how do you create these places again? And you are on a board of a group that I just can't speak highly enough about, Marketplace One. And this is a community that has formed, and it's a really tight knit. It's a YPO-esque, but really focusing on creation of community, also spurring each other on to good works. And I think that, you know, one of the things that when you have a really strong community, that community, you know, eventually needs to migrate to is that place, is consistent places where that can meet. And kind of what you're describing is really exciting on the VRBO front and some of these camp front. There's such great opportunity when you have alignment of values to then create places that foster community.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Well, Bryce, I can't thank you enough. I think hopefully listeners really got to hear why I just think so highly of you. And we end each podcast with what we call our final four, and it's this four really simple questions, and you can provide simple or not simple answers to them. But the first is just, what book do you recommend most to your friends or colleagues?
Oh, that's a really hard question. Because we've been talking about, I'm actually looking over at my bookshelf right now. Because we've been talking about property, I would actually honestly say Evicted by Matthew Desmond. And he's a professor at Princeton, runs the Eviction Lab. And it's a powerful look and an indictment on kind of the housing crisis in America. So I highly recommend that.
Yeah. Well, thank you. We'll include that in the show notes. What is one place that inspires you?
Man, these are great questions. I would honestly say the back porch of my farmhouse.
watching bald eagles take out
that's
ducks.
Right. Yeah, I mean, my wife and I sit out there every morning, drink our coffee, and it's just gorgeous. And just love looking. Really, having dinner last night and just watched a storm kind of roll across, and I just love it.
That's wonderful. What's one hope that you have for the residential industry? So we're talking that a lot of our audience are leaders in multifamily residential. So what would be your hope for this industry?
That's a great question. I do hope that we begin to think more about these blended strategies that you and I have had a chance to talk about here. Because I think at the heart of every person that's kind of working in that industry for the most part is a desire to build place and community. But I do think it's going to require some non-traditional structures and thinking. And I think, unfortunately, sometimes we don't bring our whole selves in those conversations. So I'd love to see more of a blended strategy and collaboration among different types of capital to really build community.
You're here. And last question, Bryce, what are you grateful for?
Man, more than anything, obviously my family. I'm grateful for friends. And to your point, like the Robert Putnam thing is real. And there was a report that came out earlier this year just about the decline even over the last couple of decades on friendship. Mm-hmm. And I think we just don't talk about it enough. And I think friendship itself and the importance of friendship in our culture is so diminished. And so I'm just grateful for good friends such as you.
Well, that's a great way for me to end it. Is I'm grateful that I get to be friends with you, and thanks for again. You just combine deep thinking about what is important and what you want to do in the world with wonderful plans and execution of action. Could have a whole nother podcast about leadership that I think you would teach us a lot on. But yeah, I'm really grateful for you, Bryce, and your example.
Thanks, dude. Appreciate
Thanks
the time.
Thanks for being on.
Yeah, man.
If this episode of Placemaking was valuable to you, please share it with your friends and colleagues. If you liked what you heard, give us 5 stars. And if you don't, I guess you can give us 4. Special thanks to our guest today and to Abby Nivens, our producer of the Placemaking podcast. She's a rock star. Until next time, keep being purposeful in the places you make.